Well, should we do the prelims then? The prelims are, it is Tuesday the 18th? 18th of February 2020.
Correct.
I am Patrick Crozier, you are Brian Micklethwaite.
I am.
We're doing one of our recorded conversations, and on this occasion it's on the Falklands War.
And my question is, why? Because it's a strange subject, isn't it?
And my question is, what was it? And I think, I mean, for the benefit of our younger listeners, I think we should...
Well, you should, because you know more about it than I do, I'm sure.
Well, I don't think I'll be exactly...
All right, let's start with that question. What was it?
Yes, okay. Well, it was a war between Britain and Argentina over the Falkland Islands, which are about 300 miles away from Argentina and 8,000 miles away from Britain. It was fought in... 1982, between April the 2nd and June the 16th or thereabouts, and it started with an Argentine invasion of the islands and ended with the British taking them back. Yeah, is there anything we need to add?
Well, clearly you have more to say about it than that, and the question what happened is a bigger one than just the answer you've given. So what? How do you want to expand on that? I mean, I'm guessing you were an adolescent while this was happening, right?
Yes, I was.
And I think that's the sort of thing that makes people very curious about what happened, isn't it? You want to know particularly about the public events when you were just beginning to notice public events.
Yes, I mean, well, I wasn't just beginning, but that's an age where you remember everything.
Yes.
It really touches you.
Yes.
Actually, for a long time I hadn't, because I mean, my memory of it was, first of all, absolute fury that Argentina had invaded. And then, once the task force has sailed, absolute certainty that we were going to win. It's only now that I'm a bit more aware of the realities of that war that you realise that actually it was a bit closer than we thought.
Well, I've been doing a little bit of homework just to get some clue as to what happened. And some military guy on the British side said soon afterwards, six more good fuses and we'd have lost, because there were bombs landing on ships that didn't go off.
Yes.
And if they had,
yes,
then the diminished amount of kit that the British Army had to make do with would have been massively further diminished to the point of disaster. That's how close it was.
Yes.
And it was only because the aeroplanes flying over the ships were too low and the bombs didn't work.
It certainly would have been interesting to see. I mean, we simply don't know. I mean, this is counterfactual history, as they say, and we just simply don't know what would have happened had the initial attempt to take back the islands failed. Because Britain would still have had nuclear submarines, and as a military officer said, you know, nuclear submarines scare the shit out of the Third World. And Argentina, obviously, for the purpose of this conversation, was part of the Third World. So Britain would have found it fairly easy to stop any ships going in or out of the Falklands.
Hmm.
So.
Couple of nuclear subs could have besieged the islands, is what
you're saying. It's essentially, yes. The Argentines would have had to have made the Berlin airlift for them, the Falklands going. So it would not have been easy.
Mm.
And Britain could have remounted something at a later stage. That's a possibility. But yes. Yeah. Did the officer also remark these fuses were British built?
I don't remember that. What was also said by the person reporting this remark was that actually it wasn't the fuses, they worked as advertised. It was the fact that the bombers were too low when they dropped the bombs off. I don't know why, but it didn't have long enough to work or something. But anyway, you can well imagine those bombs going off, and they didn't.
They didn't, exactly.
And there were ships stuck in harbour with unexploded bombs on them, with lots of kit in them. Yes. But people too frightened to go in the ship, you know.
One of us talks of a story, a bomb lands on their ship and they spend ages trying to defuse it and then throw it over the side. And about 5 minutes after they throw it over the side, an order is received over the net saying, you know, do not defuse bombs on your ship, just leave them alone.
That goes to a point that I didn't grasp at the time, which was how much of a organisational shambles a lot of it was.
Now, what sort of things were
you thinking of? Well, lots of miscommunication between intelligence people and the army commanders, between the ships and the soldiers, and all sorts of... It was much closer to the edge of chaos when it was happening than it felt like as when I was a civilian watching TV stuff.
Yeah.
I mean,
the one I know of is...
I mean, that could just be I'm ignorant of warfare, and warfare's always like this. I mean, that's part of it.
Don't know. I have to think about it. I mean, the thing I was going to add to that sort of chaos was the original sailing of the task force. I mean, there was tremendous political pressure to get down there as quickly as possible, to get going as quickly as possible, with the result that they just bunged stuff on the ships in no particular order, which caused all sorts of problems later on when they're trying to get it off the ships in a rush, and you can't do that. And it was realised that they could have spent about a week more just packing the ships properly, and they'd still got down to the Falklands in time. So, yeah, that's another example of the chaos that goes on.
But at the time, the fact that it was all put together in 3 days was regarded as logistical virtuosity of the greatest sort.
Yes.
That's how it was presented, because when you do a thing like that, you aren't only trying to maintain military momentum, you're trying to maintain propaganda momentum.
Yes.
The feeling that everything's going according to plan.
I mean, that's something that really annoys me, actually. I mean, I know at the time I was personally desperate for them to get going. But now, the more I know about the military, the more I respect them and respect that things don't always go quite as quickly as you'd like them to. And that taking your time, well, is often worthwhile. Actually, it saves lives. And imagining myself to be, a prime minister, I would take the view as I'm air cover for the military. I want to make it as easy for them as possible.
Yes.
But I'm not aware of any politician fighting a war who's like that, whether it's Margaret Thatcher or it's Winston Churchill or it's Lloyd George. They demand things get done now. Not recognising the military.
Well, it's terrifying how much of the Second World War turns out to be propaganda, in the sense of not so much beating the Germans as impressing the Americans. But on the other hand, to be fair to those talking about creating this illusion of brilliance and virtuosity and superb advance and no problems, it would appear that the morale of the Argentine defenders was terrible, and one of the reasons was because they had this overwhelming sense that events were going against them.
That's interesting you say that, because I haven't read or seen or watched or heard any really good Argentine accounts. I'm not even aware there's an official Argentine history of this. I'm not actually aware of official British history, because that's going on to think of it. So I don't know how they felt. I mean, it's odd how their morale works, because on the one hand, and the British military were very clear about this, you would not meet an Argentine who wasn't convinced of the rightness of the invasion.
And that's not the argument, though, is it? It's whether... I've been doing some homework in the form of reading this book, The Battle for the Falklands, by Max Hastings and Simon Jenkins.
Oh, right.
And this morning, I just read the conclusion of the Battle of Goose Green. And it was extraordinary, because the British officers in... Was it Tupara? One of these...
Tupara.
Paras, yeah.
The 2nd Battalion of the Parachute Regiment.
Persuaded the Argentines to surrender. And when they did, about four times as many bods came marching out as they'd been expecting, all in a very sorry state of mind.
It is remarkable. Essentially, there was something of an intelligence failure, because the Argentines had reinforced Goose Green, and
on the other hand, it was a pretty colossal military failure by the Argentines not to win. I mean, given how many
this is the remarkable thing. I mean, the British were attacking and they were outnumbered.
Yes.
And I mean, I'm a First World War sort of fanatic. And the point about the First World War is you have...
you have to be 3-1 to attack or something.
Something like that. And even then, it's not certain. But you are having British victory after British victory where they are outnumbered. And they're using not only similar equipment to the Argentines, but not dissimilar equipment to the ones they were using in the First World War.
Apparently, during the Battle of Goose Green, there were moments when the Paras were throwing away their guns and picking up the guns that the Argies had left on the battlefield, because they were better for some reason. I think they may just have been lighter or longer range or something. But that happened.
They would certainly have been picking up the ammo, because it was exactly the same ammo, I think, I'm right in saying.
Well, this was actual guns.
Oh, wow. Wow. They were also very short of ammo.
The sense I get from having read this book, and got at the time, was that the British army was just a serious army, whereas the Argentine army was just a bunch of civvies in uniform, by comparison.
Well, one of the problems they had was they hadn't fought a war for over 100 years. And the fact that the British army keeps on fighting wars, you know, keeps it up to date with
when things. Was the previous biggest war? Was it Malaya or probably Korea? What was their most recent?
Well, of course, they've been fighting in Northern Ireland since 1969.
Of course.
But that's a very, very different sort of conflict.
Yes, but it's conflict, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's life and death. It's
I mean, it might help to keep you on your toes. I'm not sure there's any other way in which you would help in something like the Falklands. And, of course, they're maintaining the British Army of the Rhine.
Yeah, but maintaining the British Army of the Rhine is one thing. Actually fighting is something else again, isn't it?
No. Indeed.
And, I mean, the sort of personification of all this is Colonel H. Jones, who at a critical moment during the Battle of Goose Green had to maintain the momentum. We were talking about the momentum of the war. Well, it was exactly the same with this battle. He had to keep pushing forward despite the extreme difficulties. And he played his own personal card in the form of himself. He in order to maintain the momentum.
Yeah.
And
we should point out, he got killed trying to storm a machine gun nest.
Yeah. Hastings is the military half of this duo that wrote the book I've been reading. He says it made sense because he had to keep that momentum going. That's what he was signalling to his entire gang.
I mean, this was something that the got repeated again and again after the conflict. The importance to keep going, to keep the momentum going. Mm. And part of it was because they were under such a time constraint.
Mm.
Because the flyers, because there's the naval flyers and there's the RAF there as well, are saying, look, we can't maintain our aircraft for more than a month. We're going to run out of spares and they're going to deteriorate and they're going to need major repairs and that's all you're getting from us.
So well, the point I was getting pressure. At with I mean, of course you're right, what you just said, but what I'm getting at is that something about the British soldiers is saying to all of them, we're soldiers. That means we can die, because that's what we do when we get unlucky.
I'm not sure they felt like that. Well, I'm really not sure they felt like that.
Well, they did. They didn't like it. God knows they didn't like it. No. It was not least because it was so bloody cold and they didn't have proper clothing because of all the cock-ups you referred to.
I thought they did.
But the point I'm getting at is, the British soldiers, for all their miseries and grumblings and complaints, had a sort of self-image of themselves as soldiers who get the job done, and all this sort of cliche-ridden talk they do about what they're for.
Mm.
And the personification of this is Colonel Jones. Whereas the Argentines, their self-image, we're humans, we're Argentines, yes, patriots, yes, but are they people who go out and have fights in meaningless places and get killed if that's the way the breaks go? I think they didn't see themselves in the same way.
Except the...
Some of them did. I mean, the pilots of the planes.
Yeah.
Some of them did. They just didn't have enough soldiers with that mentality.
I'm trying to think, is that true? I mean, I would guess Goose Green, they had actually been defeated, because they were constantly having to move back, the Argentines.
Hmm.
And they got to a stage where their position, I would guess their position was untenable. And it was the fact that the Harrier came over and cluster bombed them.
Yeah.
I think that certainly
concentrated
minds. Yeah. Yes. And I think there's also a bit where they herded all the Goose Greeners into a school. And I think Keeble, when he was trying to get a surrender, said, look, you know, you've got a choice here. You can, you know, if you keep going, it's war crimes tribunal for you.
Mm.
And we're, you know, you could get shot.
Keeble was the man who replaced Jones, yes, in command of the regiment, wasn't,
yes,
he?
Yes, he was. Yeah. Yeah.
And he got a DSO for his pains. Jones got a VC.
Yeah.
This book has all the medals at the back. There's an appendix with all the people who got gongs. It makes the point that it was actually quite a big operation.
I was going to say, how small it
was.
Well,
compared to the war between NATO and the Warsaw Pact that never happened, it was rather small.
Yes.
But it was pretty big by the standards of British military activity.
The weird thing is, I mean, when you look at the casualties in, say, one of these battles at, say, Mount Harriet or Two Sisters, the ones further towards Stanley, which came a bit later, and I look at the casualty figures and I think how small it is.
Because it's quite.
Any First World
Goose
War
Green,
battle
Goose
I
Green,
know of is
the British
huge.
Casualties of Goose Green were 17 dead.
Yeah.
And 30-something wounded, I think.
Yes. Which is tiny.
Yeah.
I suppose, I mean, the truth is, and maybe it's a good thing, it probably is a good thing, that we don't get these sorts of casualty figures because there hasn't been that's the only, you know, Western power against Western power, if you count Argentina as a Western power.
Yeah, I was a bit unhappy with your description of Argentina as Third World. I mean,
it was someone else's description.
Yeah.
That's what I was saying. And because, yes, I wouldn't say Argentina is Third World normally.
I think in some ways the war was almost a relief to spectators because it wasn't one of these complicated wars with lots of civilians whose hearts and minds were having to be won. It was an old school war fought on a battlefield. The civilians were just, they had their preferences, certainly in this one they definitely had their preferences, but they weren't joining in.
No, people in London were not getting bombed as a consequence.
In effect, it was an old-fashioned battle where there was lots of landscape and our guys and their guys and lots of weapons.
Yeah.
But none of this business of making sure you don't, I don't know, kill the other fellas too violently in case you upset the local villagers and they stop cooperating and all, you know, nothing like that. It wasn't counterinsurgency.
Oh, no, no, no.
Rather oddly, in this book, they describe it as a bit like counterinsurgency. I don't agree. I think it's not counterinsurgency.
No,
from what my opinions were.
Yeah, quite.
What are your recollections of the time? What you remember being very angry that they'd stolen the.
Oh yeah, I was absolutely furious. I'm pretty sure that everyone at school had much the same opinion.
What school was this?
It was I'm a bit dubious. It called itself a grammar school.
Mm.
It wasn't a grammar school. And it could technically have been a comprehensive. I'm not quite sure. But certainly it expected to send some people to Oxbridge every year. So
good.
It was a highly academic school.
Very good place. Yeah.
But yeah, I think with one or two peacenik exceptions in my class, everyone was pretty angry and expected us to. Fight this out. This is the thing we took before. I mean, this is not your experience at all.
No, it's not. I remember being baffled that this had even happened. And one thing I do recall being very surprised by was the attitude of the Labour opposition. Thatcher was Thatcher, of course.
Mm.
But Michael Foot was much more gung-ho for the war than you might have expected. And I think the reason is that the Labour Party then,
we should point out to our
was extremely pro-Parliament. And as far as they were concerned, this was an insult to the British Parliament. This is not how you you rearrange the borders of the British state. The Falklands were a British protectorate, weren't they? I think that's the technical term.
So similar to Lord North's Parliament at the time of the American War of Independence. You can't go independent. We haven't told you you can.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And whereas you'd expect Thatcher to be like that, it's a bit of a surprise to realise that I was surprised when I didn't hear more peacenik talk from the Labour Party.
I'm actually very surprised at this. I can't know what I thought of them, but I did not associate the Labour Party with any great robustness on this subject at the time.
Well, I thought they'd be a lot less robust.
Right, I see.
Knowing what I did of them, you know. And I was then at the alternative bookshop having huge rows with anybody who was pro-Labour about economic thinking. And I think part of it is that as far as the Labour Party was concerned, the Argies were even worse than Thatcher.
Yes.
That made
we should point out that at the time, Argentina was a military dictatorship, had been for about 6 or 7 years, and before that, another form of dictatorship under Perón and what have you.
They'd had a dirty war against their local communists.
Well, we say dirty war, it's basically they're taking a communist out and killing them.
Mm. Yeah.
And I saw a number. Apparently they killed 30,000. That's one estimate. Which is extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. I think that
does a lot to explain the attitude of Labour towards them.
Yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, must do.
I don't remember at the time putting it together like that. I just thought Labour peaceniks, you know, all these CND demos, way they were trying to undermine NATO at the time. It surprised me a bit. But mainly what I remember was the utter ignorance of the general public as to what the hell this was all about and what the Falklands were. You know, where are these? I mean, when I was working at the alternative bookshop, the big map shop in London, Stanford's, was about 400 yards away. It was a short walk away.
Yeah.
And we were getting people who'd come from Stanford, look, long shot, I know the answer's no, but have you got any maps of the Falklands? No, of course we haven't. And if we had, we'd have kept them. But it just shows you that London, I remember on the day that it all kicked off, when the invasion happened and Thatcher made it clear she was going to argue it, London was full of people saying, what are these Falkland Islands and where are they? Are they in the South Atlantic or is it the Pacific? You know, they were just utterly confused.
I knew perfectly well where they are, but then I'm the geekiest child.
You would know that there was a big naval engagement in the First World War called the Battle of the Falkland Islands.
I didn't, but I do now. Yes. I think... No, sir, I don't think there's any doubt in my classroom of where they were and what the principles at stake were and the need to fight. By the way, you were talking about Labour resolve. There's also Margaret Thatcher's resolve, which is not as clear as people tend to think. People tend to think, you know, this is the Iron Lady and she was up for it straight away, but apparently she needed a certain amount of persuasion. There's this famous event where I think it's the Admiral of the Fleet or the First Sea Lord, Lord Lewin.
Oh, Lewin.
It Lewin or was it? Maybe it was Leach.
In full dress uniform.
Or something like that, yeah.
One of those.
But he shows up on the night at Parliament and demands an audience with the Prime Minister, which is not, you know, shows some gumption. And it's him who persuaded that the islands could be retaken. But even then, she would much have preferred a negotiated settlement. The problem is, as soon as the Argies had invaded, well, what could they do? They couldn't exactly take their troops off and hand it over, because it was so popular. And it would look like a climb down.
Well, it would be a climb down.
Yeah.
I remember there was a play called The Falklands Play, or something like that, on the TV, after it was all done and dusted, which emphasised the political side of it. And it actually, one of the interesting things about the play was that it reinforced the sense of an inevitable military victory with no serious problems, because it was all over in about 2 minutes, the fighting.
Yeah.
It was all about getting a UN resolution accepted. And it was all about the relationship between the different politicians. And there was a scene in it where Thatcher was saying to the cabinet, look, are you serious about this? Because if you're not, now is the time to say so, and we won't do it. We won't do this. And she sort of looked round the table. And quite clearly she would have been willing to say, well, if we don't have the bottle for it, we're not going to do it. It wasn't her doing leadership so much as saying, look, are we serious about this? Because if we're not, we can't do it. Which goes to your point about her uncertainties. One of her uncertainties being, do I have the political backing for this?
Yes.
And I think that also goes to the point that Tories often have extreme doubts about these things, don't they? Not least because they often contain quite a few officers who experience war and don't actually quite like it. You know, they're not...
Well, they didn't at the beginning of the First World War. The one thing the Liberals, who themselves were divided, they could depend on was the Tories to help them out, because they were
But the Second War, where the politicians were often junior officers in the First War, that was one of the basic reasons for the uncertainty in 1940, wasn't it?
Is that right?
Oh, I think so. I mean, people like Halifax. I don't know what Halifax's behaviour... I don't know what his First World War record was, but you're talking about people whose... If they personally haven't fought in the trenches, then they've got a million friends who did and half a million who died, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, numbers are all wrong. But that, you know, are we seriously going to have another of these Holocausts? That was the argument. And in a smaller way, that argument happened in London.
I mean, I suppose, this is one of the fortunate things, is by if you're sailing that distance, you need ships. And because ships are very expensive, you can only send so many men. I mean, you know, you can afford to lose ships, but you...
Well, you know. You can only afford to lose so many.
Yeah.
There is the uncharitable suspicion that Leach, he was an admiral, wasn't he?
We must check out if it's Leach or Lewin.
Lewin, one of those guys beginning with L-E, yes,
yeah,
a high up. But I think what it has been suggested that the Navy welcomed the chance to show what it could do.
Well, it was in deep trouble because there had been a defence review, 1980, maybe 81.
Well, of course...
Which is, slashed the size
all
of the,
to do
the
with
Navy.
What kicked the thing off in the first place, because they were they withdrew ships from the South Atlantic.
They were in the process of withdrawing the Endurance. Well, the Endurance is still there at the time. In fact, at the moment,
what is the Endurance?
The Endurance is an Antarctic survey vessel, but I think it was Royal Navy, although it's painted red for some reason, or was painted red for some reason. I'm not sure if it carried any armaments, but it was being used because the whole thing started when some scrap metal dealers showed up on South Georgia, which is another 700 miles away from the Falklands, and put up and hoisted the Argentine flag.
Was that a freelance operation, or was that?
I think to this day suspicion reigns, because they looked awfully disciplined for a bunch of scrap metal workers, shall we say. Standing in ranks and saluting the flag and singing the national anthem.
I mean, the background to all this is that the Argentine government had a lot of domestic broils, and in the usual Shakespearean manner, it needed a foreign enemy to pull everything together. That was one of the things that got it all started, given the background of Argentinians all agreeing since the year Dot that these islands were theirs, and it was an outrage that the British insisted on keeping them.
Yeah, well, you should. Well, yeah, we had to remember that Argentina at that stage had something like 100% inflation, and despite the junta killing 30,000 people or whatever it was, there were still lots of riots and demonstrations. So it wasn't going all their own way.
But the British basically didn't pay attention to what was going on in Argentina, or enough attention.
I'm not sure that would have helped. From all I know, the British policy was sort of two things at once. On the one hand, they wanted to get rid of the islands, actually. But on the other hand, they wanted to maintain international law and self-determination. Unfortunately, those two positions are entirely incompatible, because you have these annoying 2,000 Falkland Islanders who utterly refuse to become part of Argentina under any circumstances. There was no bribe or nudge that the British government could give them that was going to change their minds. And, well, why not?
I get the feeling that there's an Ulster Unionist talking to me right now.
Yeah,
it has that feeling about it.
Ah, you, maybe
does
that's...
It, does that cause you to have a deep feeling? Because to me, the Falkland Islanders are just... They might as well be birds of paradise, in the sense of they're completely different species to me. I'm a sort of suburbanite Londoner.
Well, there's a question. What would I have thought at the time? It's all very mixed up with for me, because of what sort of Irish I am. Because my family is Southerners and they're Protestants, which is a rare beast, as you might say. Although I think at that time I would have been a thoroughgoing
Unionist. I've long had this sort of uncharitable South of England view that the Northern Ireland Protestants are as weird a bunch of foreigners as the Northern Ireland Catholics or the Irish Catholics. They all talk in funny voices, definitely including the Ulster Protestants.
Yeah.
And I think probably our mental category, also the White Rhodesians, another oddball collection of people. And that's where we put the Falklands. I mean, okay, they weren't as plutocratic and they didn't own vast coal mine or diamond mines or something, but they were sort of...
I'm surprised every interview I've heard with a Falkland Islander says this is kith and kin. Even the ones who have New Zealand accents, and there are an awful lot who have New Zealand accents in the Falklands. Sheep, I guess. I think in the case of Northern Ireland, the accent is a barrier. Because grating.
By the way, I'm not proud of my attitude. I'm just trying to describe it.
Yes.
I didn't really give it much thought, is the point. Certainly not until the war erupted. And I think the same goes for a lot of Brits.
Yes, I think that's true.
And by the way, the Falklands War confirmed a prejudice I've long held about warfare, which it's often thought that hostility between different nationalities causes war. I think it's the other way round. I think war causes hostility. Speaking as a Tottenham Hotspur fan from a distance, I can't help remembering that there were two very prominent Argentinian members of that Spurs team in the 70s, I think, Ardiles and Ricky Villa.
Yeah.
And it was only after the war got started that the Sun newspaper started flinging the word Argy around.
If I remember correctly, those two disappeared more or less immediately.
Yeah, they did.
After the Argentine invasion. Mm. So it's within that sort of pause where there's actually no fighting going on.
A precaution.
Yeah,
very wise.
Very wise, yeah.
But it tells you something that Ardiles later became the Spurs manager. He wasn't very successful, but they didn't have any objection to the guy in principle.
No.
So I think it does illustrate that point. And actually the war ended quickly enough for that sort of war propaganda, jingoism, anti-Argentinian stuff not to get seriously boiled up.
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly true that I will cheer our Argentine player at Watford.
I'm sure that Maradona goal, which he punched in with his fist, caused at least as much anger to the British people as any Falklands contretemps.
Well, not to me, shall we say?
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the interesting question is which of us is remembering the majority point of view. I don't know. It also goes, another big part of all this is...
Well, Brian, I don't... I mean, yes, maybe the Falklands factor. I mean, a lot of people attribute Margaret Thatcher's victory in 1983, in the 1983 general election, to the Falklands. And certainly, prior to the war, the Tories had not been doing very well because, well, there was a depression in this country. Mm. Yes, I think that actually there are people who say actually the Tories were recovering and the economy was recovering, but I think we have to add in the Falklands factor, and that is a majority opinion that Britain had the right to.
Well, one thing I'm very clear about is that as soon as the task force sailed, I wanted them to win because I didn't want my country humiliated. And I think quite a lot of people were in that category of, I'm not quite sure what it's all about or what the rights and wrongs of it are, but we definitely don't want, you know, aircraft carriers being sunk and all that in a faraway place.
Yeah.
Of which a month ago we knew nothing. But now we're learning. It's interesting to speculate how much the effects of the British winning the war impacted subsequent events. One thing I think is pretty clear is that if there'd been a serious disaster in that war, I don't see how Thatcher could have remained Prime Minister.
No. And things might have been very different, not least that we might have ended up with a Labour government.
Yeah. But I think the Labour Party, despite its very kind of patriotic performance during this war, it was in a right old state at that point. My opinion is that people have somewhat exaggerated the impact of the war on the next general election. I think Thatcher had... Her number one aim was to get on top of inflation, which you mentioned that it was 1,000% in Argentina. It was pretty scary by British standards England. It was... I can remember the price of a cup of coffee going from about 10p to about 30p. Christ almighty, what's that about? I mean, now they're £3.50 or something ridiculous. But at the time, I remember thinking, this is way out of control. It's got to stop. And she was getting on top of it. And we had a British government with a coherent economic policy, which it was pushing through successfully. And I think that would have been a good case to make during the election campaign. As it was, the campaign wasn't a campaign at all. It was just Margaret Thatcher wandering around the country, waving like the Queen and, you know, winning.
Well, I can remember being slightly livened up by Dennis Healey, the Labour deputy leader, accusing Thatcher of glorying in the slaughter of war. Mm. Which at the time I was inclined to give some sympathy with him, but now it's really outrageous.
Mm.
Quite, it's an outrageous remark anyway, but it's just simply not true.
Mm.
Margaret Thatcher was very concerned about the troops that would be killed.
Well, that was the point she was making to her cabinet. You know, people are going to die. If we're not serious about this, then it's unforgivable. It was a moral question. It wasn't just a political matter.
Yes.
Are you unsure about this, and you're going to send young men to die for something you're not sure about?
Mm.
That was the point. So, that backs up what you're saying. I think the feeling was one of relief at the end. Well, thank God that didn't go 10 times worse than it might have.
Yes.
Anything more to say about the actual course of the war itself?
Well, we've covered logistics, haven't we? And we've covered...
Speaking as a plane spotter, I think the Harrier jump jet was one of the... It was like almost like the Spitfire of that war, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It went into the war, people being very unsure about what the point of this peculiar contraption was, and at the end of it they could do no wrong, the Harrier pilots. Apparently the pilots were much more persuaded by the Harrier than anybody else was.
Is that right?
When they first got their hands on, this is a serious piece of airplane, this is, we love this, we can do all sorts of things, and they were able to turn very fast, and even much faster jets, they had trouble nailing them.
Well, again, I mean, the big problem for the Argentines was that the Falklands is the limit of their range. So they couldn't dominate the Falklands.
Mm.
And they weren't flying...
We should mention the Belgrano. The captain, did you know that the captain of the Belgrano was a man called Bonzo?
Yes, Hector Bonzo.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Funny name.
We should say, well, the sinking of the Belgrano was extremely important.
He said, fair cop. You know, we were doing no good to the British fleet. We had orders to sink any ships we came across. Fair dues. You know, that was his attitude. That's what he said, apparently, afterwards. I think there was a bit of confusion about this thing called the total exclusion zone, which somehow suggested that if you kept out of it, you'd be safe. But that wasn't what it meant. All it meant was if you're in it, you're definitely going to be sunk. But if you're outside, well, still a war.
Yes, it's a very... And this is something I wonder about. Because the sinking of the Belgrano is tremendously controversial. And I don't know why. There was a war on... It is an enemy ship. It is an enemy warship. And what do you expect to happen if the opportunity arises to sink it? Well, don't you do that in wartime?
I think it was because it wasn't a fair fight. It was a nuclear sub that just chopped it without warning, I think, wasn't it?
Well, no. Subs don't, by and large, warn people and warn suddenly enemy warships.
No.
You don't.
But I'm trying to explain the state of mind of ignorant civilians in these matters. It had the feel, you know, if it had been two battleships like the Bismarck against the Prince of Wales or something, you know, bang, 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 and one of them wins, well, jolly ho. But there's something sneaky about a submarine attack, I think.
Well, all's fair in love and war.
Well, except that a lot of people don't think it is.
Yeah.
Also, I think the sneaking feeling that the Argies, they weren't really top-notch sailors. They were just kids who'd been dressed up as sailors. There, the weakness of the Argentine military effort, which is the basic attitude of the people doing it, the British kind of felt that the crew of the Belgrano basically didn't deserve to be drowned like that.
Well, yes, I mean... What would they have felt themselves?
Any more than those goose greeners deserve to be incinerated.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I think was going on. I'm trying to...
I thought it was essentially the left trying to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat.
I think it was that as well, yes.
And the way they go on about it, went on about it for decades afterwards...
That's the sort of reason why I don't think Labour would have won that election.
Mm-hmm. Because they were so divided about it. Mm. And the odd thing is, yes, there's this whole controversy about it. The other thing about the Belgrano is how decisive it was.
Oh, yes.
Because after that, the Argentine Navy went home and was condemned by Argentines afterwards. It was a bit of a shame, because really, what could they have done? All they could have done was sailed out their aircraft carrier and had that got sunk as well. I mean, that's all they could have done. A thousand more people died. And that's all the difference it made.
How many people did die in the Belgrano?
About 300, thereabouts.
So more people died in the Belgrano than the entire British casualty list.
Yes.
Which was 260 something, I think.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Another potentially interesting stat is that most deaths occurred at sea, not on land.
Well, there was a big muck up with an attempted transport of troops from when they were going from where they'd landed to Port Stanley. Basically, a two pronged attack, north and south of the right hand of the two islands, as you look at the map. And they tried to speed up the southern bit by taking a boat trip, basically.
Yes.
And the boats, when they got to the far end, they didn't disembark quickly enough or something and got bombed. And that's when a whole bunch of casualties happened. The Welsh Guards suffered terribly.
I have watched quite a lot about that, and I'm still rather confused as to what happened.
I
think one of the problems is it's just very difficult to supply.
Mm. What my guys tell me in this book of theirs is that Marines, by their nature, understand when you arrive by boat in a contested area, you want to get off that boat double quick. Whereas the Welsh Guards didn't quite have that in their culture, and they were a bit slow getting off.
And the story I've heard is it was a chain of cock-ups, because they were supposed to be coming in by landing craft, and so they came on this big boat called the Sir Galahad or Sir Tristram, both of them. And so they were rowing ashore. And I think there's also some business about a field ambulance. Now, that, I think, is not an ambulance as opposed to as in a vehicle. It's an ambulance as in a dressing station or a surgery. And they decided to get the ambulance off first, and probably correctly. But they had to leave the Welsh Guardsmen there. And the other thing, of course, is that they're coming in daytime. What was that all about? I think just things just went wrong. There's just a few things going wrong, and it's all a disaster. But I'm still not quite clear about what actually happened. But it's war. There's something I wanted to mention was actually I talked about my emotions on the day the Argentines invaded, but there's also the other thing was when the Sheffield, HMS Sheffield, got sunk. And that was a terrible shock at the time. I mean, looking back on it, you recognise that, well, that's what happens in war. You lose ships. But still, it was very shocking, the realisation you were in a war.
How many people died in that?
20. Which is, Belgrano terms, nothing.
Unless you happen to be one of them.
Yeah.
Also, another very odd event that happened during this war was that strange bombing raid on Port Stanley.
Oh, the Vulcans.
Yes.
Yes. So you tell the story, shall I?
Hastings, you do it. I've been talking a lot.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, the Vulcan was originally designed in the 50s to drop nuclear bombs on Russia. And it is, I think it's one of the most beautiful things ever taken to the air. It's a very beautiful, it's got a delta wing, and it's just a very beautiful plane. Anyway, in its 20-year history, it never done anything. It never actually been called to
drop a bomb
in anger. And I think the RAF were desperate to be involved in this war somehow, because mainly it was the army and the navy.
What made the whole escapade so bizarre was the way that you had this enormous fleet of bombers setting off, with all of them filled with petrol or whatever, air fuel. And they took it in turns to fill each other up until there was just one left far end.
Yes.
And it managed to get one bomb onto the runway or something. And again, rather like the sinking of the Belgrano on a small scale, it had a big deterrent effect out of all proportion, because they could never have done this again, I don't think.
Well, there were several. These were called the Black Buck Raids, and there were several of them. And I believe the first one was the most successful, and they got one bomb onto the runway. But my understanding is the Argies were quite clever about this, because they actually made it look like there were craters in the runway when there weren't any.
Really?
And my other understanding is that there were Hercules flying into Stanley up until really quite late in the war. So maybe these raids weren't as successful as possible, but certainly the effort involved. And I'm sure there must have been, some Argentines thinking to themselves, well, hang about, a bomb has just landed. Where did that hell did that come from?
Yeah, exactly.
Because we're pretty sure the task force is too far away.
How the hell did a Vulcan turn up over the Falkland Islands? Yeah. That would have been the question.
Well, would they have known it was a Vulcan?
I don't know. I don't know whether they would have seen it.
But I suppose it would have made the intentions quite clear. And if that had a psychological effect, then that's a good thing.
I mean, the thing you forget about war is that, if you've never taken part in it at all, is that it may well be that your side is in a desperate state, but if the other side's in an even more desperate state, you're still winning. Or if you keep fighting, you're still winning. If you stop, you lose.
This is the thing I've been dwelling on recently, is that, the difference between winning and losing from a personal perspective is not great. Because winning is awful. You are seeing men being killed, you are tired, you are cold, you are too hot, you never have all the equipment you want, and all you're really aware of is you're going forward. And the thing you're not aware of is that, as bad as it might be for you, it's worse for the other guy. And I think that was a big part of the story, and in the Falklands, because it was, we mentioned the cold and the wet earlier on, but there's also the fact they had to walk.
They lost helicopters
in the
Atlantic. I forget conveyor. Now which ship was it?
The Atlantic Conveyor.
That's right.
There was a huge. I mean, that wasn't the only source of helicopters. They had a lot of Sea Kings and Wessexes around. But I think Julian Thompson, the brigadier in charge of 3rd Brigade, did say, you know, you can never have too many helicopters. Mm. They are so useful for moving stuff around.
So
they lost their Chinooks, except for one, which somehow managed to be not on the Atlantic Conveyor at the time. So, yeah, things were very tricky. And it's very unpleasant because, you know, they had to carry everything. And then the loads are enormous, 60 to 100 pounds. And you're in boggy conditions. And sometimes it's boggy and sometimes it's stony. And it's never comfortable. And if you miss your step, well, that's an ankle broken, or you're stretched away, and that's awful for soldiers too. Because they feel as if they're letting their mates down.
Mm.
How do they do it? It's extraordinary. I mean, again, one can only imagine it's worse for the Argentines. And you hear stories. One thing that someone remarked on was that the Argentine officers did not go on patrol with their men.
Yes.
Now, why is that important? Because if they're not going on patrol, the patrols tend to take it easy. And so they give inaccurate reports and say they looked at things that they didn't look at.
That seems to me to go to the state of mind. I mean, the contrast with Jones. The thing that they said about him, he never asked his soldiers to do anything he wasn't prepared to do himself.
There are Argentines like that. I mean, in the...
They're just not enough. The Goose Green ones, apparently the officers involved in the Goose Green battle on the Argy side, they weren't like that. They were just at the back. And it was rather like the things that used to be said about First World War staff officers. Mm. It had that feeling to it. And it can't be a good attitude. Can't be good for morale at the front if that's what your officers are doing.
Although I could add that the story about the initial invasion, Argentine invasion of Falklands, was that one guy got killed. Apparently, it was more than one, but so the one who was named was a very brave soldier and a very effective soldier.
Yeah,
happened to be in the right place at the wrong time.
The comparison I have in mind is the Italians and the French during the Second World War. It's not that they had no worthwhile soldiers; they just didn't have enough. There were too many of them, weren't that great, and not enough of them had this thing that you've got to have. I'm waving my fist. I'm acutely aware that I do not possess any of this quality myself, but I think I know enough about warfare to know that it's very important.
Well, of the little I have read up about the fall of France in 1940, I'm inclined to think the French did have enough people of the right sort of quality. I think it was just very bad luck in that case. They just didn't have the right forces in the right place at the right time. I think
the upper reaches of their command was
Gamelin and people like that.
Wasn't good.
I've also heard things about their general strategy, because they realised they weren't as big as the Germans, and it would take time for the French and the British to combine to defeat the Germans. So the whole idea was to be on the back foot originally. And there's a whole problem they had about Belgium, which was initially an ally, became neutral in 1934. So do you build your Maginot Line behind Belgium and say, well, tough guys.
Yeah, the equivalent for the Argentinians was Chile. Apparently they had a terrible headache with Chile because they'd been having a big fight with them about, I forget what.
The Beagle Channel, I think.
So they had to keep lots of their best guys back just to keep an eye on them, which made a big difference. But so another question. When we were talking about the Cold War, I hazarded the proposition that the Russians were very impressed by the Falklands, by the British effort in the Falklands, and that this would have just turned down their optimism a notch for the potential Third World War that they were thinking of having in the late 80s or whenever they were imagining they might. But do you think there's any truth to that? Hastings is rather scornful of that, because as far as he's concerned, amphibious warfare is one thing, and you know, the plains of Europe are something else.
Well, it's a point about morale, isn't it?
I think if mentality and just determination to just fight is what really counts, then you can imagine the Russians being a bit impressed. However, a point that...
Can I talk about Able Archer? I'll talk about Able Archer. Able Archer was a NATO exercise which took place a year after the Falklands in 1983. And the Russians convinced themselves, this is Andropov at the time, that this, I mean, it was a big exercise. This big exercise was a prelude to a preemptive strike on them. And they had a whole chart grid of things that were going to happen. And once the grid had been filled out, that meant the war was about to happen.
And it was all filled in. It all happened.
As it happens, it wasn't. But,
oh.
The point being, the thing that really impressed them was actually Ronald Reagan's rhetoric. That really spooked them.
Yeah.
When there's talk of an evil empire.
Yes.
And resistance. They weren't... They were a bit shocked by that. But it seems the Falklands was not a factor in their calculations. Although, yeah, had Britain not fought, obviously, they might have had a slightly different attitude, but... As far as I'm aware.
The trouble is, the British effort just wasn't big enough to loom large in their calculations, was it? I mean, the thing, what Hastings says in this book is that the bits of the British army that had prepared for this kind of fighting in places like Norway and, you know, sort of NATO exercises way off in the Arctic, they did very well, whereas the bits that were bodged together by people who weren't prepared for this exact sort of fighting weren't so successful. That's what he says.
No, indeed.
And the trouble with the British forces that were prepared for this kind of thing is there just weren't enough of them to make a huge difference to, you know, to World War III. So I my attitude towards it is somewhat modified compared to what it had been. I would dial that down a bit, but it can't have done any harm, let's put it that way.
No, and I think it's ultimately a sort of... They might have been thinking that the West would fold quickly. Well, if Britain is not going to fold quickly...
And the very oddity of what the British accomplished in the Falklands, the fact it was such a faraway place, and yet still they did this, it kind of reinforces the point that these British have got something about them.
Yeah.
They're irrational in a way you don't like.
Well, you do think, how many countries at the time, or even now, could have done something like that? And yes, the Americans could. The British did just. Could the French? Could the Russians? Could the Chinese? I don't think so. The distances are so colossal. That is the real thing about it.
8,000 miles.
But it also demonstrates that naval power is something else. If you can dominate a sea, which is weird because sea is the ultimate wilderness, but if you can dominate it, you can win your wars, actually. It's remarkable what you can do. You mentioned this whole business about the trained troops. I just like to add a bit to that. It was three commando brigade, which included two Royal Marine commandos and I think one a battalion of paras, which is weird to me, seeing as a the paras and marines don't tend to get on very well. And yes, they trained a lot in Norway. And so starters, they had all the right kit. You know, the real cold weather gear. And also, a crucial point that Thompson, who's their commander, makes is they all knew each other. The higher officers knew each other. I mean, he could talk about H. Jones as a personal friend, someone he knew and he'd worked with and respected. So they all knew what each other could do. And I heard that also in relation to the First World War. When the British originally went out, they had one corps and two corps. One corps had worked together, I think this is the right story, and two corps were strangers. And it all makes all the difference. And the Third One Corps did a lot better. But because of this, it just, you know, that's, those are these personal relationships.
Yes. In my understanding of battles is that critical is how you feel about the people to your left and to your right. If you feel they've got what it needs, what they need to have, you're much more confident. It makes a fundamental difference.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. I suppose
that,
yeah.
I remember reading Robert Graves' memoirs from the First World War, and he pointed out that if you were fighting a battle and the people on your right were solid, you knew they'd be pitching in. That was such a big difference. Whereas if you didn't feel confident in them, you were very vulnerable. If they ran away, then you were...
Well, it would open you up to a flank attack. Which exactly. Is the thing that really scares you.
I'm just trying to think. Oh, yes. The one character in this war that I haven't mentioned, who I remember being very... not impressed exactly, but struck by at the time, metaphorically speaking, was the man who did the press releases for the British government on TV. Do you remember him?
Ian MacDonald?
That's right. I think his name was Ian MacDonald. And he had this funereal manner of speaking, which was extraordinary. I mean, I think it was pure accident that he happened to be the bloke at the desk at the time, you know, and it was his job to do it. Whoa, do I? All right. And he went off and did it the way he felt it ought to be done. And I think it rather appealed to the viewers. It certainly appealed to me. There was something weirdly eccentric about it. I mean, there was something very agreeably non-military about it. The man wasn't trying to inflame public opinion or anything of the kind. He was simply reading rather slowly.
I think he was interviewed later on, and he did say... Oh, by the way, I mean, did you ever see the Private Eye cartoon?
No.
With this guy? I mean, just for people who aren't familiar with the way he spoke, it had him and giving an announcement, and the caption was, "By the time I have finished this announcement, the war will be over."
It was very slow.
But he was making the point. I mean, I think he was being deliberately slow because he wanted everyone to understand what he was saying, and he wanted to take all the emotions out of it. It was just entirely factual.
That's right.
And good for him.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, I thought he was bizarre at the time, but yeah.
Oh, I didn't object to it, but it was bizarre.
Yeah.
It was a really strange experience listening to this man. Mm. And you could see he was there to be seen as he read out this stuff.
Yeah.
But I found it... there's nothing worse than what Rudyard Kipling refers to as a jelly-bellied flag flapper. a civilian... Oh, and the other phrase I remember is Saki, H.H. Munro, who talks about the reckless courage of the non-combatant. It's a very disagreeable state of mind to witness, and MacDonald didn't do that.
No.
That was what was good about it. I think people said, I remember people saying
at some point he was going to, I'm sure he was the man who announced the Sheffield has been sunk.
Mm, yeah.
And if you can't be a jingoistic and then say, oh, well the Sheffield's been sunk.
Mm.
Well, you can't say that in a jingoistic manner. So, yes, I think he got it right. You could have speeded things up a bit, mate, but yeah.
Dictation speed is what they call it in this book.
Ah, right.
Which I think makes the point.
Maybe that was the reason.
Hmm? Yeah. I mean, this was not a time when people had little recording machines, was it?
Would journos have had? No, they would have had.
Would they?
And
yes,
I'd be amazed if there weren't microphones present.
This brings us to the point that there was apparently a lot more needle between the media and the army than had been obvious at the time. Maybe if you were paying close attention.
Of course, Hastings was there, wasn't he?
Mm, yeah.
So,
but there were moments when, I mean, I haven't read the whole book. I dipped, but during Goose Green, which is what I did read about, there was a moment when the British soldiers were trying to get some sleep in miserable cold conditions. And then that suddenly it was the BBC said, oh, the British are wherever they were and they're about to attack Goose Green. Oh, you know, they had to get up and be ready to be attacked.
Yes.
When they really didn't need this, you know, and their commanders.
And I wonder how that happened. I mean, surely someone at the MOD is telling journalists, you do not tell... Say any. In fact, how did the information get to the World Service, one wonders?
Well, what Hastings says is that this was a war where the army expected the journos basically to be, you know, the Royal Corps of journalists, fighting for our lads with their own particular or rather strange weapons. But as far as the journalists were concerned, they were dispassionate searchers for the truth. They were simply reporting events. It wasn't their job to put a British spin on it. And there was that culture clash going on, the way it hadn't happened in the Second World War, for example.
Because the journalists were on our side.
Yeah.
Eventually, yeah. Yes. I mean, another example I was given was apparently it was something like the British had broken the Argentine codes. And then a Labour MP gets up in Parliament and says the British have broken the Argentine codes, with the result the Argentines changed the codes, and that was it.
There you go. Yeah.
That, how many lives did that cost?
I do remember my father getting very angry on a Sunday while the task force was lumbering southwards at the amount of information that was being published in the British Sunday papers, full of maps with arrows, or they might attack here, they might attack there. And my father, who was involved in all this sort of secret stuff during the Second World War, and used phrases like "our gallant allies" to describe the Russians, which is apparently the way they did, with a slight sneer. And he had lots of books about Enigma long before it was commonplace knowledge. So he was obviously deep into that world in some capacity or other. And he got very angry with the amount of stuff that the newspapers were printing. At the time, I thought... My feeling was this was blind them with overwhelm them with information.
Well, I can't remember which Gulf War it was, but in one of them, I heard some sort of report, and there's the report is saying with great confidence that the attack will be right flanking or something like that. Everyone expected this, but of course it wasn't like that at all.
Yeah.
And I wonder if. Now, was it because this is the military catching up?
I think so. I think it was. I think one of the lessons that the British Army learned from the Falklands War was we've got to get a grip on our propaganda activities. One of the military historians I read a lot, partly because I'm personally acquainted with him, is Peter Carrick Adams. He has had a whole career, in addition to writing popular history of the Second World War, he's also had a career as an army information officer, and he's the sort of guy who gives lectures at Sandhurst on this very subject, and I'm pretty sure that the Falklands would have been mentioned in some of his lectures to the officer corps of the British Army, basically. So my sense is they've learnt a lot about this kind of thing. In other words, they realise they can't take their partisan support for granted. They've got to kind of charm their way towards it. They've got to get them on side rather than just assume that they are. Because you're talking about people with no experience of warfare, that's the thing. The journalists of the Second World War were part of a military culture. They had brothers who were officers, Less so now, because the army's so much smaller.
And it's so long since we had a general war. It's difficult to see the circumstances in which we would have a war where everyone fights, every man fights. Any other points you wanted to make?
Don't think so.
No, I think I'm done too.